Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to this very special Empire podcast dedicated to Joe Wright's Pan, which is out next week. It is, of course, a retelling of the legend of J.M. Barrie's Boy That Never Grew Up. This one is an origin tale. This tells the story of how young Peter Pan, played by Australian newcomer Levi Miller, is an orphan in London during World War II, and he is brought to Neverland. There, he forms a friendship with Captain Hook, who A, doesn't have a hook, and B, has some good in his heart this time. He's played by Garrett Hedlund. Together, they team up, along with Tiger Lily, played by Rooney Mara, and they trawl through Neverland to try and take down the nefarious Nirvana-loving pirate Blackbeard, played by Hugh Jackman. This is an interview special in which I and Phil DeSimleon talk to Joe Wright, Hugh Jackman, Garrett Hedlund, Rooney Mara, and Levi Miller. Three very fun interviews. Do stick around. First up is Joe Wright, and he was talking to Phil DeSimleon about his unique vision. Enjoy.
Joe Wright, welcome to the Empire Podcast.
Thank you very
Many
much.
Many thanks
indeed.
For finding the time in your very busy schedule
to
talk about Pan. Just to open up with another one of your films, on Anna Karenina, you grew a sympathy moustache.
I did.
In sympathy with your cast.
Yes.
You didn't go sympathy baldy Hugh Jackman on this movie.
No, I realised that actually that it was unnecessary. I did a sympathy backbend for Rooney Mara one day.
How did that go?
Really badly.
If you're
I'm 44,
like me,
you shouldn't do backbends without limbering up. I was trying to express the fact that if you pre-visualise something, you find you're able to do it. And so I said, listen, I can't do a backbend, but I'll try for you now. And I pre-visualised doing a backbend, and then I went into one and I did it, but I nearly broke my back in the process. I bent over backwards for...
Quite literally.
For Rooney.
Is this the beginning of a new career in practical pre-vis?
No, it was kind of the end of a dream of being a mime artist. I know, that's why I wanted to...
Yes.
When I was like little, I really wanted to be a mime artist, and I was a bit fat. And so I said to someone who knew about this stuff, I said, how fit do you have to be to go to Marcel Marceau's Lecoq mime school in Paris? And she said, you just need to be able to do a backbend. So I spent months practicing doing a backbend, little tubby Joe.
And of course you were also the great Kazam.
Yes, the great
magician
Kazam, yes.
As well as a mime artist.
Yeah, the great Kazam used to perform illusions in the piazza at Covent Garden. I used to go down there every Saturday and do magic busking. And it was quite a good little earner.
Was it?
Yeah, I used to make about 30 quid a day, which for a kind of 11-year-old is pretty good.
That's like hedge fund money.
Yeah.
For an 11-year-old.
Yeah, exactly. I used to plough it all back into the business though. And I'd go, after my day's busking, I'd go up to Davenport's magic shop, which used to be in front of the British Museum, and I go and spend all my hard-earned money on new illusions.
That's amazing. Remembering your younger self, Levi was, he's 11 now, isn't he?
Yeah.
But he presumably was, I guess, what, 10 or 9 when you auditioned him?
He's 10. No, he's not. He's 12 now.
Right.
And he was 11 when we met.
How many kids did you see altogether, roughly?
Over 4,000.
Unbelievable.
We even had an open casting at Wembley Arena and had like queues round and round the block. Some adults turned up in Peter Pan costumes as well, which was a bit weird.
None of them got close, I guess, to the
part. Excuse me, yeah, no.
Amazing. So is that a fun process or does it get a bit of a grind? I mean, obviously you have to...
No, that's not a fun process at all. Especially because you're kind of shattering the hopes and dreams of thousands of children. And also you have to start kind of appraising children's talent and go, no, he's no good. And you don't want to talk about kids like that, do you? You want to kind of go, they're all great.
Yeah, but you were the great Kazam.
Yeah.
So in a way, you've got insights into how good they should be.
Yeah.
They're not making 30 quid a day, adjusted for inflation.
No, there was a bar, you know, that was set. I remember when Ken Livingston took over the GLC, he banned anyone under 16 from busking. And so that robbed me of my audience. And I was devastated. And I tried to get work as a children's entertainer, but I just felt the audience were beneath me. And so that, in fact, was when I started making films.
Thank you, Ken Livingston,
Thank you, Ken, yeah.
In a way. I wondered... Just to sort of put this film into the context of your career, this is, I guess, the fourth literary adaptation that you've done.
I don't really see it as being a literary adaptation, though, because although the characters are based on Barrie's original characters, it feels like a complete reframing of the Peter Pan story. When I first read Jason Fuchs's screenplay, it was one of the most original screenplays I've read. So I never really saw it as a kind of literary adaptation.
just to put this in film in the context of your broader career, this is the second film that you've made that has a fairy tale element to it.
Yes.
Is there a third in the trilogy? Little Mermaid is the film that keeps coming back to you.
I don't know. In a way, I see them all as being fairy tales, really. Certainly, you know, Pride and Prejudice is a fairy tale. She gets her prince in the end, you know, quite literally. Atonement is about fairy tales. It's about a character who tries to get the world to conform to her ideas of how a story ought to be. I guess The Solarist was less of a fairy tale. Maybe that's the way it was the least successful of my films, I don't know. And Anna Karenina has a kind of fairy tale element to it, although a kind of very dark one. I see them all as fairy tales, I guess that's what I'm saying.
Looking back at Atonement, a film that lingers for a lot of people, it's got, I mean, what a cast. You must look back and think, wow. I mean, Saoirse Ronan has obviously gone on to great things. Benedict Cumberbatch is in that film. You've got Danny Mays. Even Neil Maskell turns up as bloke in pub.
Yes, true. I love actors and I'm kind of quite involved, I suppose, in the London theatre scene. And I get to see a lot of these actors before they've had their big breakout performances. It's a very rewarding thing to be able to give someone like Carey Mulligan her first job in Pride and Prejudice and then see her blossom into the kind of great actress that she's become.
And what happened to Benedict Cumberbatch?
Benedict, well, you know, I kind of felt like Benedict was a star when I cast him, but I suppose he wasn't. Yeah, no, he's amazing. And it's a real privilege to bear witness to those people. It's happening now with Alicia Vikander, who, you know, had her first English speaking role in Anna Karenina. And it's brilliant to see them do so well.
Can we talk about your relationship with the music? Not just this film introduces a lot of, I guess, a new generation to the Ramones, for one thing. And also, of course, Smells Like Teen Spirit, a rabble-rousing sing-along.
Yeah, I guess those moments just came out of the rehearsal process. I had a fantastic week of pirate boot camp during rehearsals where all the pirates came and kind of learned how to go rawr and so on. And we all dressed up and it was really an opportunity for Hugh to get to know his supporting cast as well, his crew. And we were playing lots of music in the rehearsal room and we were trying kind of sea shanties and so on and they didn't really feel tough enough. And then we put Smells Like Teen Spirit on and suddenly the room kind of started pogoing and everyone singing along and it felt like that was something, an energy that I wanted to see in the film.
With your Australian cast in mind, was there any pressure to have some Midnight Oil involved or?
Not so much.
You play music on set though, don't you?
Yeah, I play a lot of, I mean, basically I see my job as sort of set DJ and director. I have a sound system kind of set up on the stage and I have an MP3 player that is linked to the sound system and I play music all day.
Amazing. Are there any other directors who do that?
I don't know, to be honest
with
you.
I don't think Terrence Malick does that, for instance.
I don't think Terrence does it, but I love it. And I find it relaxes everyone and also communicates to them the kind of atmosphere of the day. So that when we were doing Atonement, for instance, and in the scene in the library, the love scene in the library, we were playing Mark Lanegan's Wedding Dress song. And then when we were doing the scene between Peter and Blackbeard in his cabin, we were playing an amazing piece of music by Max Richter called On the Nature of Daylight, which is a very tender kind of piece of music, fragile piece of music. So we kind of, and then if I need lots of energy, I'll play, you know, the Chemical Brothers or whatever.
Chemical Brothers, of course, you were at their first ever gig, weren't you?
So their first London DJ gig above the Saxon Shoe Shop in Islington.
Just before I let you go, I know you don't have a project next, but I just wonder what happens next for you when you finish promoting this movie and you've obviously done the premiere, the film's out. Do you go on holiday or do you start to look around? Do people start calling you up?
Is that no, process I start started? Worrying. I start worrying and I start kind of thinking what I might be interested in next. But that process has already started, although I don't know what film I'm going to make next.
But no backbends?
No, certainly never again am I going to do that.
Joe Wright, thank you very much for taking the time to chat. Really
appreciate
it.
Thank you very much indeed.
That was Joe Wright, the director of Pan. Next up is the villain of Pan, Hugh Jackman, a.k.a. the evil Blackbeard. His beard is now gone. His hair has grown back. He's now the lovable Hugh Jackman we all know and love. He was talking to Phil and myself about all sorts of stuff, including, obviously, Blackbeard, Nirvana, the next Wolverine, and tons of things. Do enjoy. Delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by Hugh Jackman, star of Pan. How
Thank
are you,
you.
Sir?
Good to see you guys. I'm great.
Good to see you. The other day, Hugh, I don't know if you know this, was International Talk Like a Pirate Day. And you didn't tweet anything. You didn't talk like a pirate on Twitter.
I didn't.
What was up with that, honestly?
Well, it was actually communicated to me as something different, that it was International Day of the Pirate. As I was like, I said, I'm not sure if this is really great. We know what's going on in Somalia. Are you sure this is something we should be endorsing right now? And then I found it was talk like about the day after, so the I missed the boat. Yeah.
Oh, man.
But would you like to give me your best pirate?
Best pirate. Oh my God.
Come on.
My best pirate always sounds like someone from Cornwall.
Yes, West Country.
Right.
Arr.
That's right.
Arr, is that right?
Well, they kind of were.
Yeah, I guess they were.
Yeah, we had a Cornwall actor, Mike, on this show, and that's where all the pirates, that's where they all sort of jumped on the ships from Cornwall. So hence, that's where it comes from.
But you're a pirate. You're Blackbeard.
Yes, it was the opposite.
A bit more educated than... Not that to suggest that people from Cornwall are not educated before anyone writes in.
But again, that's being cut out.
Historically speaking, a bit more educated.
Yeah, well, no, pretentious. I actually think he probably was one of those pirates. He's complete show pony, Maya. Yeah. I'm chewing up the furniture in a big way on this one and having a great time. And Joe was like, go for it. He loves the sound of his voice and loves being on show and just loves dressing up and doing all that stuff. And that's sort of his thing. Because I think, in a way, if you look at all the pirates, there's something really kid-like about them all. We're in a kid's imagination. So Joe said, the only rules I have for all the adults in the movie is that they appear as adults appear to kids, which is frightening and ridiculous. So that was our template.
Was there anything from the real Blackbeard?
Oh, you know, it's...
Because I gather he had an incense.
Yes.
Yeah, tell me about the beard.
Well, I had been reading with my son the Junior National Geographic. It had this whole thing on Blackbeard. As Joe said, do you want to meet about it? I was like, oh, I've done my research. Surely it's not the deepest research I've done. It was the junior version. But they had this picture of him and talked about how he used to glue in incense sticks into his beard, this big, long, matted beard, and light them on fire before he went into battle. So as he jumped onto your ship, the cut looked like his head was on fire. And I said, oh, this, what do you think? And he goes, no. I said, oh, okay, what do you think? And he had on his iPad a picture of my head with this sort of superimposed white cracked makeup on and the wig of Marie Antoinette and the costume of Louis XIV and all these kind of wrappers, rings. And I was like, yeah, okay, that's better. And he said, no, I see a man who's just a complete peacock, show pony, moody. And that was the thing that I loved about Joe. He said, for me, and I agree with him, the scariest adults were the moody ones. Yeah. The ones that one second would give you a hug and here's a chocolate and this, and the next thing would just like slap you around. Like you never knew what they were going to be like. So that was our template.
Just like a switch,
Yes.
You've got to keep an eye. Yeah. I can't help it. Volatile.
Capricious and terrifying in the one
just,
in one go.
What would be scary about going to battle against a man whose face smells like a student's?
Yeah, no. musk.
You really think that generally?
You are killing me.
And of course, you go bald in this one as well.
Well, they did give me the option of wearing a bald cap, and I said, "How long does that take?" And they said, 45 minutes. I said, "Give me the clippers."
Wow! And your kids loved it. I gather
they loved it. Yeah. I mean, they thought I looked really weird and odd. And my son said, "Now I know why your friends called you P-head at school." We went to Disney World, like. Probably for someone like me, the worst place in the world you can go if you're trying to look forward to having some fun with your kids. And it was my daughter and three of her friends. And I just didn't get recognized at all. Like, I mean, I got stopped like 3 times in 3 days, mainly for drugs. But but my favorite bit.
Again.
And I had none on me. You know.
Disneyland's the best place to score drugs, as we all know.
Yeah.
It's the only place
How do the dads get through it, you know? But my favorite was at our hotel, there was this one slide in the pool, right? And it was pretty short sort of slide. And my daughter finally got the courage to do it. So she did it 100 times. And there was this one girl there who looked like a bit of a stoner, to be honest. And she was sort of on her summer vacation, whatever. And she was looking at me every time I came up. And I was like, oh, damn, I've been recognized. And this is bad because I'm in the hotel now. And I thought, once she tells all the staff, blah, blah, blah. Finally, it was about my 6th time going up there. And she goes, dude, you look like a pirate, man. And I was like, I am a pirate. She goes, yeah, you go, pirate, go. And every time I went down the slide, I could hear echoing, go, pirate, go. Yo.
Well, of course, I mean, I'm looking at your head of hair. You're not one who's going to go bald anytime soon.
I'm doing okay.
You're doing all right, yeah.
Although my son did say to me, he goes, really, Blackbeard? It's more like black and white beard, Dad. So...
That's all right, let's distinguish.
You're copying a lot of shade from the kids.
Yeah.
True, isn't that what they're there for? Isn't that what they think that's their job? Particularly, I think it's good, actually. No, my kids are very honest. And they're honest about the things that, like, my son is like, I don't understand Hollywood. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, why wasn't there a sequel to Flushed Away? They make a sequel to everything. But that was the best movie ever. Like, he loves that movie. Yeah. And he goes, why didn't they make a sequel to that? And I said, we did lose about $70 million on it. Maybe that could be why.
Let me show you a spreadsheet. That's why there's no Flushed Away 2. But I agree, there should be a Flushed Away 2. Yeah. What is going on, honestly.
I was going to ask about the pirate workshops.
Yes.
And Joe said that a lot of things came out of them. Aside from, I guess, the chemistry of you guys as a cast and the spirit, I guess, to approach the film. Mm. But also the music as well.
Yeah, no, that was...
Nirvana smells like Teen Spirit. There's a bit of Mad Max almost to that sequence.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. There's that eccentricity that Joe has that I think people are going to love about the film. You know, particularly in England. I think the English, they love, like, the costumes. And there's one scene, it's kind of like a kaleidoscope. It's just a little trippy almost. And you're in Neverland. Why not? You know, we did one scene with me and Peter, and in front of the camera, he just had shards of glass sticking up, so it was refracting light. And it was almost like being in a 1970s, you know, like music clip or something. He just goes for it. And third day into rehearsal, you hand around sheets of paper like that, you know, with the lyrics to Nirvana's Teen Spirit. And we presumed it was some kind of, you know, improv or voice warm up or something. And he goes, no, I'm thinking this for the entrance. And I was like, yes. I mean, it's the perfect entrance to Neverland. It's a great entrance for my character, but it just says to the audience immediately, you say, come on, you're in Neverland. Just let it go. Don't worry. This is not real life. This is in a kid's imagination. Just go on the ride. Have the adventure.
Does this mean that Blackbeard is officially the author of Smells Like Teen Spirit?
Yes, you didn't know that?
I did not know that.
Yeah. And it's funny, I thought I knew the lyrics. I really didn't. And if you go around to people, particularly on a drunken Saturday night, people start singing, but they really don't know. And it's funny seeing a whole bunch of 11-year-olds singing those lyrics. Because
they don't know.
They actually have learnt them, but they still don't know what they're singing.
So there's stuff like a mulatto.
Yes, yeah, an albino.
Yeah.
A mosquito. My libido. Yeah, they're like,
Mr. Chapman, what's a libido?
Yes, exactly. And the parents shuffling them off quickly to catering at lunch. Come on, kids. It's Joe Wright. It's disgusting.
Well, let me show you another spreadsheet. were you a Nirvana fan? Yeah.
I knew the song. I did know, not overly, not massively, but yeah. I'm not as rock and roll as my character appears.
Is the P.T. Barnum movie, which is an original movie musical, which is very rare these days.
Very.
Is that going to have anachronistic sound cues, music? How's that going to work? Do you have any idea? Have you heard it?
Yeah, no, we've been working on it a lot. So no, it's not going to feel like a period piece musically. It's going to feel modern in that way. You know, we all feel that that's the only way to go. There's a couple of nods, but yeah, no, I think you have to throw away those rules, and it's not going to sound like music hall or some kind of thing that is 100 years old. You know, it's going to feel very modern, and I think it should.
Does the songs play into your decision to take the role in the first place?
For Barnum?
Yeah.
Huge.
You see the script, but you also hear...
Everything.
All of it, yeah.
That's why they say musicals is the Mount Everest. Yes, the script is going to be great. Yes, the music is going to be great. Every single one. Everything is going to be great. You can't... Every department of a musical is going to be great, and it's just that much harder to get right. I mean, if you think of most movies, you make the script, you cast it. So you write the script, you cast it, you film it. And then the whole soundtrack comes in later. I mean, Joe had a couple of songs in this, but you tailor it to what you're seeing, because this all has to be worked out before. It's so hard to pull off. It's going to take time, and we're just taking our time because there's no point in doing it unless it's going to be great.
You famously played Gaston on stage in Beauty and the Beast. And
I don't know how famous it is,
well,
but
I'm
thank you.
I'm going to say infamously, yeah. How should we say?
Oh, I see, yes.
You know,
peed my pants.
Had a moment.
Peed my tights.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Are you disappointed you weren't able to reprise that for the film version coming up? I mean, that would be...
That's interesting. Yeah, I kind of hate when actors say, yes, I was offered that part. But let's just say it wasn't Gaston, but there was some talk like, are you interested? And I actually couldn't make the time for another character actually in it. And part of me really thought about it, but it was a timing thing. I think Bill is fantastic, and I loved doing that show. Playing Gaston every night was a blast, and it really, really works, that show. There's something like that animated musical still holds up. My kids absolutely love it. There's something really brilliant about it. So I'm really fascinated to see how it goes. And Luke's playing it, right?
Yeah, Luke Evans.
Absolutely. And he's a great guy. I've met him a lot. And when I saw the photo of him, and I was like, oh yeah, that's much better. He has a way better Gaston chin than I have.
I was lucky enough to pay my first visit to Comic-Con this year.
Oh, really? This is your first time, really?
First time.
How did you find it?
Yeah, really amazing. It's a little overwhelming to start with.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's even more overwhelming for you at times.
Yeah.
But I was sitting in Hall H on the Saturday. Right. It was kind of a farewell, wasn't it? And I guess it won't be your last trip to Comic-Con.
I'm hoping I go, you know, at least one more time when this last Wolverine's out, because at the core, those people in Hall H, which are the core, particularly for those big sort of announcements, when I first started in 1999 on this, you know, Comic-Con was about a tenth of the size, and the internet had not really taken off, and people didn't really know how to measure the fan base, and they were really hardcore, and those hardcore fans sort of made it happen. And I know that because I remember the projections. I remember how surprised the studio was with our opening weekend. I think at the time it was the fourth highest opening of all time, right, for a weekend. And no one expected that. And that's when people realized the fan base is much bigger than we expected. It's huge, and they are really passionate. And, you know, I'll be honest, not all the movies have been great, and some have been great and some have not been great, and they've stuck through the whole thing. And I think the series is getting better, and I would love to be there at the end to say thanks particularly to them.
So when do you start on the
last
Wolverine movie?
The plan is sort of next year, sort of early next year. We're still finalizing the script, and we're not going to start until that script is absolutely perfect. I've got a really, really clear idea in my head of what this movie should be, is going to be, and I won't do it until it's that.
You said Old Man Logan in the past.
I might have been being cheeky. Yeah. Maybe I wasn't. Maybe that's for real. But I feel like Old Man Logan.
Nonsense. Yeah. You could play this character for the next 20 years.
Maybe.
Is there a sense of regret in the way that you're hanging up the claws?
No, if I had regret, I wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
It feels like the right time. I don't know if you can ever really predict it. It's a bit like the stock market. No one knows where the top or bottom is. I don't. But I would hate to miss that moment when I have the chance before I get kicked out of finding the right time to leave the party. I mean, if I can equate it to real life, it's like this is one of the best parties I've ever been to. But there's going to become some point where it's diminishing returns, not only for me, but for the audience. And so I don't want to be delivering in that zone. Mm. And I actually had a great chat with Jerry Seinfeld, you know, which was one of the precipitating factors to me actually deciding to finish it. He's a friend of mine, and I asked him about the end of that series, and he just said he knew, and he really cleverly said, I'm a big believer to leave something creatively, like feel that you might have a little bit more, but he said that will feed into whatever you do next, and then we'll see if in 5 years I'm begging the studio to let me back as Old Man Logan.
You should do Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee with Seinfeld. That would be
there's only one problem.
Technically a comedian.
I was going to say that is plural on comedian.
But you posted the Oscars,
it could be
so
comedian,
okay.
Comedian and actor in car
that'd
having
be
coffee.
Fine. That'd be okay. I just want to ask one last thing about Wolverine. You're not in X-Men Apocalypse.
Who said? How do you know?
I was on set. And,
really?
And there was
the entire time.
There was a lack of Jackman.
The entire time.
A Lackman.
Were you there the whole time?
The whole time?
You were there.
I wasn't there the whole time.
So how do you know?
I don't know.
Hmm.
But I was
Let's
told.
Leave that hanging. You were told that I was not there.
You're a tease.
Yeah, I am a tease. You know me, I used to just tell everything, and then the studio's like, really? You had to tell everyone that? Like, come on.
But then again, I was told as well you weren't going to be in first class.
Right. Well, actually, I didn't know I was going to be in first class. Because Matthew Ramey said, I got an idea for your first class. It was like a year later that I did that cameo. And I was like, guys, do you want to shoot me? Because I know you're in New Orleans or Mississippi, wherever they were. And I said, I'm sort of this side of the world. Do you want to shoot it now? And they said, oh, we don't know if we're going to use you. So it was a last-minute decision.
So this third Wolverine...
It's actually still my favorite Wolverine moment, probably.
It's great.
Yeah.
It's absolutely amazing.
That and the other one, I like, you're a dick. That one. In the X-Men 1, that one works.
Both of them are swearing. What does that say?
Pretty much, exactly.
Which is want to ask, wrapping up, about one cameo you did this year, which was in Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, one of my favorite films of the year.
Oh, one of my favorite films too.
It's amazing. You cameoed as yourself, but not as yourself.
As Wolverine.
In a weird,
it was very weird.
Yeah, an Australian Wolverine.
With the poster of Wolverine talking, but it was the Hugh, the actor, talking about, like, really, you're going to be talking to this girl with cancer. It was very odd, and I went in and filmed it, but I love Alfonso. That film, everyone should see that film. I don't know, how did it do here? Did it do well?
Yeah, it did well.
Yeah.
It did well. Critics loved it.
So good.
Did that come about? Was that just a natural? Hmm. I mean, did he call up and go, I want you to be yourself, but not yourself, if you know what I mean?
It was in the script, as done. And I just thought, this is perfect. So I was glad I did it.
Fantastic.
Thanks, guys.
You, thanks very much.
All the best.
Thank you.
That was the great Hugh Jackman there. And now to round off this very special Pan podcast, we have a triple whammy. It's an interview with Rooney Mara, a.k.a. Tiger Lily, with Garrett Hedlund, a.k.a. Captain James Hook, and with young newcomer Levi Miller, who was wearing a set of Pan pipes around his neck. He, of course, plays Peter Pan, and they were talking to myself and Phil Dissemblian. Enjoy.
We're delighted to be joined the Empire podcast by Rooney Mara, Garrett Hedlund, Levi Miller. Hello, how are you all?
Good, thank you.
To see you. Garrett, you said something before we started. And I'm going to pull you up on it. You've only been on one podcast before. And Dave Navarro's podcast?
Yeah, he's got a podcast that used to record every Wednesday night. And some of my friends and I would sit around, have a couple glasses of wine, and call in, pretend to be random characters with very extreme problems. You know, because it's one of those podcasts asking for advice, or if it's, you know, I can't find a girl or something like that. And then we'd call in with something quite extreme. And that became our annual Wednesday night.
Did he know you were doing this?
No.
No. Has he ever known?
No.
Okay, no. Excellent. And what sort of characters did you do? I'm not asking to do one.
I'm not even going to say, because then it's going to be found.
Yeah. People will be rooting through the internet right now.
Yeah.
Rooney, ever been on the podcast?
No,
ever
done, I've
ever prank called a podcast before?
I don't think I've been on a podcast.
Yeah. And Levi?
No, never before.
You should do that after this. Prank call podcasts incessantly.
Can we talk about the initial audition? Because that process sounds astonishingly daunting. Even for someone like you who's actually played the character before. And I have the photographic evidence from your Twitter feed.
I want to see. I haven't seen that.
Have you not seen this? Do you mind?
Absolutely.
This isn't great radio. But we'll put a picture in with it. Talk us through this picture so people who are listening can understand.
Sure. I mean, it was...
I want to keep this photo.
Yikes. That was when I was five or six, I believe. Five. And I did a character reenactment of Peter Pan. And it was just a little monologue, but I won, which was cool.
But you're fully in costume. And
yes. Oh, wow. What?
Hey, it was on your Twitter feed.
Yes, I know. I remember that.
Having done that, the audition for this movie probably was a cinch, I'd imagine.
Very, very different.
I bring the character with me. What was that like? Because I can't imagine. It was a big casting call, obviously.
Well, yes. There was two auditions in my hometown in Australia. And then I was flown to LA for another audition. And it was my first time in the US, which was awesome. And then they flew me to London for another audition and chemistry test, which is where I met Garrett. And the boy who plays my best friend in the film, Nibs, Lewis McDougall. And that 3 weeks later, I got the call that I was going to be playing Peter Pan in Pan. It was, yes, incredible. I cried on the phone. Tears of joy, of course, but it was amazing.
Yeah, I can imagine. Do you guys have memories of your first auditions? I think I know about your first audition, Garrett. I might have seen an interview you did where you talked about some feedback that was a bit bruising.
Oh, being told I suck pond water.
What does that even, is that mean? Is that a positive or a negative?
No, man, my first audition, I mean, I sort of did similar things. When I was living in Arizona, I would call up acting coaches. I would go to talent scouts and stuff. And I mean, one of the talent scouts where I ended up getting my first manager, I think I got up and gave the halftime speech for Varsity Blues. So, 40 minutes for the next 40 years of your life. But no, my first auditions were flying to LA from Arizona. You were never given a script. It was only the sides. So you had to sort of invent who this person was. I think one of my first auditions was for like an Olsen Twins show or something.
Yeah. Really?
That's the first time I've ever publicly said that. A lot is being revealed right now.
Everyone, what was your first audition?
I can't remember what my first audition was. I mean, I had a lot of really, really bad, embarrassing ones. Mm. Hopefully those will never come to the light of day. Yeah, I hated auditioning. Some people are really good at it, but it's really kind of like a separate skill set. Like, it's very different than actually being on a set and acting. It's like, I had to learn how to get good at auditioning. I was really, really bad at it.
Did you have a special monologue prepared, like Garrett with Varsity Blues?
No, it was always just scenes. I never did a monologue.
Is there a very marked difference between a chemistry read and an audition?
Yeah, because you get to read with another actor.
Yeah.
So So
it feels less like a job interview, I guess, in that sense.
No, it's just, it's easier. It's easier to act with another actor than with someone who's just like reading from a piece of paper like that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, because early on as well, a lot of the casting directors, you go in knowing that you're not going to get anything back from them. And that was always kind of thing. And, you know, they read 100 people a day. You're trying to bring all the life you can to your characters. And what you're receiving back is the flattest, most monotone version of, you know.
Yeah. Or really, really overacted.
Oh, there were some casting directors who just throw. Just
no, they usually have like a reader there.
Ah, reader, right.
Or else it's, I mean, it's very, how are you today? And, you know, it's very opposite.
Can we talk a bit about the pirate workshops that you guys all did?
I didn't get to choose the pirate costumes, but I got to witness everyone collecting their costumes and creating their characters. It was pretty awesome.
Yeah.
My character's pretty, he's just in gray, sad clothes, but he wears the same thing throughout the film, and it's always really dirty.
It was for 3 weeks before we started shooting. We would come to these stages every day. They're over the Leavesden stages close by where the Harry Potter adventure is. And this is where Hugh and Levi and Joe and all the other pirates would gather. And Joe had had one of his relatives from up north come down who runs a theater company. And obviously because Joe's got a very theatrical sort of past as well and passion, we'd sort of rehearsed a lot of this stuff like it was going to be a play. All the characters sat down, the pirates, and got to explain who they felt their characters were. And you got to sort of know a little bit of that, and then Joe had offered us a closet that had a wardrobe consisting of dresses and sort of ridiculous, I mean, boas, and maybe recall seeing a diaper there. this is Joe's sense of humor, and everybody put these garbs on and danced around, and it was really one of those. I mean, even for Levi, like, it's his first film, but you got to see Hugh having fun and taking advantage of it and not being too proud to be doing this and rehearsing and coming from his hectic stress, and also seeing Levi sort of open up and start having a blast with it, and then it was just infectious for all of us.
Did you all feel you had a blank slate essentially with your characters? I mean, you know, I'm thinking it's particularly you, Garrett. I mean, your interpretation of a Hook is traditionally a very dapper English gent, but this is not that. I mean, did you feel you could go anywhere?
I had gotten the call one day that Joe had wanted to meet me to play Captain Hook, and obviously my first instinct was confusion. I didn't ever imagine that. So I went to sort of hear him out, and he said, you know, we're doing a sort of new spin on Blackbeard and Tiger Lily and this whole world of Neverland. And I imagine Hook to be somebody, I fancy him being from an early John Ford film, or like somebody that if he wasn't in these mines, he'd be happier on a horse in the prairie. And I thought it was really sort of interesting origin kind of place for him to start.
I was going to say, and Levi, obviously, Peter's from London. He's an orphan boy. But Rooney, your character doesn't have that same geographical kind of sense of origin.
Yeah, no,
she's
just from Neverland.
She's just from Neverland. So there you go. Do you imagine a place where, you know, she is from?
She's literally just from Neverland. Mm. I mean, like, we always kind of talked about Neverland is really just kind of, it's Peter's imagination. So it's whatever world a boy that age would imagine. Like, Tiger Lily to all of us has just always been there. Like, she doesn't really exist outside of Neverland.
So it's hard to research. You can't exactly go to Neverland and,
yeah,
and spend some time there, soak up the accents and soak up the vibe.
Well, I mean, all of the natives in Neverland, it was kind of like a hodgepodge. Like the chief was Australian. He was amazing. All of the natives, we were just from all over. So it was like there was no consistent accent or anything like that.
It looked like a fun place to turn up for work in the morning.
Oh my gosh, yeah, that set was so much fun because there was like hundreds of extras every single day and the same people every single day. God, we felt so bad for them because they had to wear the same costume, and by the end of it, like, everyone was just really stinky.
Really?
Because they would just dance all day between takes. They had the Ugandan children's choir come in, and they were part of a big scene in there doing this song and dance, and that was really cool. And that was definitely the most fun set, I think.
What about the trampoline day? I imagine that must have been quite fun, getting people off the trampoline so you could actually film on it. That must have been tricky.
Yeah, they had it pretty locked off, I guess.
Okay.
Like, so it didn't lose its spring.
Yeah, they didn't want anybody getting hurt. Joe was like, oh, this trampoline looks like some fun. He did two jumps and said, my back! He jumped on it twice and hurt his back. And here we're just embarking on this 3-week fight scene between me and this guy Taeju, who's one of South Korea's, I think he's like their number one martial artist there. Our stunt choreographer was amazing. I've worked with her before, Eunice. I worked with her all the way back on my first film, Troy. So it's wonderful to cross paths again. I mean, it was 5 harness changes a day and hanging upside down for days on end. So, but in terms of the set, with all those people, and Joe is a DJ in his own right and would constantly be playing music in between takes, and you'd have the whole stage of cast and crew dancing, and it really sort of kept it lively and kept everybody having fun and being ridiculous and feeling like a child again, which I think is really necessary on this.
Absolutely. Joe did say that he tried to demonstrate, he described it as pre-vising for you, a back bend, and his back kind of wouldn't bend because he says he's 44 and it doesn't work anymore.
Oh yeah, he what was he trying to do? He was trying to do the crab.
Oh right.
Yeah.
Did you have to help him up?
I was doing this fight scene with Hugh that we shot forever and ever. It was really hard because we were doing this fight on the ship. Like, it was basically like doing a fight on a balance beam. We had to practice for weeks and weeks, and we were doing it. And on the day that we were meant to start shooting it, we had to be on wires because it was too dangerous, but we had never practiced on wires. So we've been practicing for weeks and weeks, and then all of a sudden we had to put wires on, and it completely changes everything about the way you move and your center of gravity. So it was so hard, and I was like getting really, really frustrated. So Joe came in to sort of try and like pep talk me, and he was sort of telling me this whole story that I won't get into, but it involved doing the crab. And so he got on the floor to do it, basically telling me like, you can do it. And then he like pulled out his back while he was trying to do it.
You can do it, just don't do it like I just did it.
Well, I didn't have to do the crab.
That's true, but yeah.
I don't know where the crab came from.
just felt right.
He was improvising as a director. There are obviously the potential for sequels for this, so it kind of invalidates the question I wanted to ask, which is, do you guys get to keep anything from the set? I'm looking that you actually have the pan.
Yes, I have my pan.
Is that the act? That's not the actual.
That's the actual one.
Is it
from the film? Yes.
Wow. So you can't lose it basically for the next film, otherwise it's cancelled. The whole thing.
Yeah, it's crazy how many things that they've done to this one. They've put magnets on it. They've done a lot of things to it, but it's still here. It's
do
still
they like know it. You've got that, or do you just?
Yes, they know. Or no, I just took it off set.
Okay.
Stole it, no. Yeah. They gave it to me.
By the end of like a 4-month shoot, you really just want to burn everything, but I kept like some of my axes and I kept this other piece of my wardrobe. But yeah, that was
so at Heathrow on your way back to America after the shoot, you guys really
Well, they were like, they're kind of like plastic, some sort of plastic material. Yes. Yeah, they weren't actual axes.
With the curtains being pulled back now. Gareth, tell me you kept the trampoline.
No. Joe, when I first met with him, the trampoline wasn't involved in the script then, and it was a potential fight sequence, and the fight sequence changed a lot, and he asked me how I was on a trampoline. I grew up on one, you know, during that time when the trampoline craze was going on and kids couldn't live without one. Yeah, I grew up on one. And when we were training at the beginning and going over all the stunts, you're on this thing for 8 hours a day. So the last thing I wanted to be near again was a trampoline.
Take your work home with you. Last question, Levi. I believe you learned some Cockney rhyming slang. As a kid you grew up in Queensland, right? Have you got anything that you want to share with our listeners that's useful Cockney rhyming slang?
Ooh,
do you remember any of it?
There's apples and pears. Mm-hmm. I think that's stairs. There were lots.
Will you take some home with you for your friends? Do you think they'll have a clue what you're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to. And then I also learned some, I think there's modern slang. There's modern slang here now. There's lads and cheeky Nandos, apparently. There's a thing called cheeky Nandos, which...
Cheeky Nandos.
That's all you need. Thank you guys very much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you.
And that's it for this very special Pan podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. We have a whole host of Empire special podcasts coming out over the next few weeks. We've got an interview podcast with Guillermo del Toro next week for Crimson Peak, so do be on the lookout for that. We have the regular podcast as well, which is up every Friday. We have a Mad Max Fury Road spoiler special podcast with George Miller. That's going to be up Monday the 12th. Of October, and at some point in the next couple of weeks we're hopefully going to have a Spectre spoiler special as well with Sam Mendes spilling the beans on all things Bond. So do keep your eyes peeled and indeed your ears peeled for those. Thank you for joining us. Goodbye.